Hello and welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickel and I am the digital marketing manager here at Wipfenstock, and I'm also the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on the podcast, come stop by our website at wipfenstock.com, where you can browse our catalog and check out our blog. You're now listening to the first episode in our Potochka booth. The Potochka booth is a three-part series of interviews on the Czech philosopher and dissident Jan Potochka, who lived from 1907 to 1977. These interviews will explore his philosophical and political thought, his biography and his context, as well as his import for theology. So on this episode, I interview Dr. Aaron Plunkett. Dr. Plunkett is senior lecturer in philosophy and religious studies at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK, and she's also the editor of the Selected Writings of Jan Potochka, Care for the Soul, which was just published in 2022. So without any further ado, thanks so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this conversation. All right, so I am here with Dr. Aaron Plunkett. This is our first episode in our Potochka booth in honor of the Czech philosopher Jan Potochka. I'm very excited. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Plunkett. Before we get into things, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do maybe, and also how you came to study Potochka?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm currently senior lecturer in philosophy and religious studies at the University of Hertfordshire, which is here in the UK, near London. And I work on phenomenology, existentialism, aesthetics, many other things. I've always been interested in questions about the relationship between self and world and subject and object, our modes of relationship to one another. I haven't always done philosophy, but I think philosophy is kind of one of the ways I've tried to figure out how to ask better questions and maybe to live in a way that's more true and more open. As you can probably hear, I'm not a UK native. I'm an expat from small town Indiana. And it's a long story of how I got here, but I blame Kierkegaard in part.
Nice. Okay. And then how did you kind of come to discover Jan Potochka?
Yeah. So Potochka, I've only been reading for the last few years. He kind of came into view through a friend who was wanting to kind of translate some of his texts. And I found... First, I was very attracted to the myth of Potochka as this. So for anyone listening who isn't familiar with him, he has this status as a kind of Socratic martyr dying for the truth. And this is because of his role in the Charter 77 dissident movement in what was then Czechoslovakia. So he was the spokesman for this human rights charter that was protesting against some of the policies of the still Soviet communist government at that time. And as a result of his activities, he was questioned by the secret police. And after one of these interrogations, which was particularly lengthy, Potochka, who was already quite old and not in great health, suffered a brain hemorrhage and subsequently died not long after that. And when his death was written about in the European press, he was presented, especially by Paul Ricoeur in a very influential article, as a philosophe résistant, so Ricoeur's kind of linking him to the resistance movement, freedom fighters and that sort of thing. So I think why most people become interested in Potochka is they hear this story and there's something very noble and attractive about this notion of, you know, dying for the sake of something higher, for the sake of some truth that's not being offered and that's not available to the kind of regime in which he was living. So that was very attractive. And then I subsequently found that he had many themes in his work that overlapped with things in Kierkegaard that I was interested in. For example, possibility and receptivity. These are things that he deals with in some depth. So that's how I got started reading him. And then I got involved in the selected edition of his works as editor, where I had the chance to work with one of Potocka's students and just a titan in Potocka world, Ivan Hivatic, who runs the Potocka archives in Prague and was one of the students that Potocka that distributed Potocka's work when it was unable to be published in his native country.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen it, but there's this little short documentary. I forget who put it together on Potocka. I think it's called like the Socrates of Prague or something. You might know better than I do, but at the very end, they play some of the recording of the police interrogation. And like you said, he's already, you know, he's fairly elderly. He's 69, I think. And his voice, how kind of shaky it is and how heavy he's breathing and everything during the recording. It's quite haunting. But just as a word of recommendation for anybody listening, I think that's a really great documentary. And I think it's like 25, 30 minutes. So it's well worth a watch. Okay, so let's go to our icebreaker question before we dig too much deeper into Potocka. So if you could put three other figures, dead or alive, in a room all together with Potocka already in there, and you could kind of listen to their conversation all together, which figures would you choose and why?
I had a hard time thinking about this question. I think I would certainly love to hear a conversation between Nietzsche and Potocka, because I think one of the recurring kind of themes in Potocka's work is meaning, the loss of meaning with the death of God, and the rise of a certain kind of instrumental rationality. And he links Nietzsche to nihilism in a way that many other thinkers do. But I've always kind of thought that Potocka doesn't quite get Nietzsche right. And I'd like to kind of hear further dialogue between the two of them, since Nietzsche himself saw himself as attempting to overcome this nihilism. And yeah, I want to know more about whether there's anything promising in Nietzsche that Potocka's sort of missing. The second figure would be Foucault, who read Potocka and has some similar themes in his work. For example, the idea of biopower or biologism, and the notion of care for the soul, care for the self. And I'd like to just hear more about how Potocka would think about Foucault's kind of development of these ideas, specifically how Foucault's notion of power relates to Potocka's idea of force, and how they both think about political involvement, I guess. And then finally, Hannah Arendt, because Potocka read her, and she was a big influence on his thought, particularly about his idea of life having these three movements, which I'll talk about later. And I'd like to hear them talk about Heidegger, for one thing, since they were both students of Heidegger at one time. And also they both think about what it means to do, well, maybe not explicitly, but I'd like to hear them speak about what it means to do political philosophy. I don't know that Potocka is doing political philosophy, but there's something kind of inescapably political about his work nevertheless. And I think Arendt's kind of similar, even though she's doing something more explicitly political. So yeah, that's sort of a intellectual context for thinking about him.
Yeah, that'd be a very rich conversation for sure. Okay, so I think something that's been surprising to me is, as I've sort of discovered Potocka in the last maybe half year or so, is that whenever I say his name, even if I'm talking to like people who have PhDs in philosophy or theology, I mean, outside of the context of the school I'm a part of, it seems like almost universally, like, people's eyes glaze over. They have no idea who I'm talking about. So maybe for our listeners who are not familiar with Jan Patočka, could you just say a little bit about who this man was, and maybe what were some of the major events of his life, whether sort of personal or intellectual or otherwise?
Yes. So his life is so bound up with huge world historical events that it's hard to condense. But
yeah.
He's a phenomenologist and a philosopher of history. I think the first place I ever encountered him was in Derrida's book, The Gift of Death, where he takes up Patočka's notion of sacrifice. Patočka is a consummate scholar, a very rigorous scholar with a lot of breadth to his work. Almost everything he writes brings in the whole history of philosophy, which makes him kind of frustrating to read sometimes. And as I mentioned, he's also this legendary figure as a dissident. And I think he's someone who still has a lot to say to us now. So just to give a bit of biographical background, he was born in 1907 and died in 1977. So if you think about his life, he's living through two world wars and the Cold War. And he also lives through Nazi occupation of what was at that time Czechoslovakia, and then a long period, decades of communist rule, which was more or less authoritarian at different periods. So during this time, he was largely unable to work have a university post because of his disagreements with the various regimes or being seen as a threat. Even though, as I said, there's nothing sort of explicitly critical of the regimes or explicitly political in his work. Nevertheless, as an intellectual, he's a kind of threatening figure, I suppose. There's also the sin he committed of not joining the Communist Party. So he refused to join the Communist Party when the communists took over after liberating the Czech lands, which had been annexed by Hitler in the late 30s. He refuses to join the party and is, as a result, unable to work at a university for a very long time. But before all that happens, in 1927, he is a student, a philosophy student, and he has the opportunity to go and study in Paris at the Sorbonne. And that's where he first encounters Husserl and kind of takes up phenomenology in a serious way. And in 1932-33, he goes to Berlin. He meets with Husserl again and also attends Heidegger's lectures. So he's a student of both, and that figures very largely in his work. As I said, he has difficulty kind of holding posts throughout his life for his being at odds with various regimes. So he takes up kind of research work, archival work, that sort of thing. For a while, he even digs railway tunnels. That's during the 40s, during the Nazi occupation. One of the major events in Czechoslovakia, for those who aren't really familiar with the history of the country, is in 1968, the Prague Spring, as it was called. So this was a period where there's still a communist government, but there was a kind of new freedoms, some greater freedoms were sort of opening up. And it was a time of immense optimism and possibility in the country, big student movement, as you saw in other parts of the world. But Soviet troops and their allied countries cracked down on that in a really brutal way, sending tanks rolling into Prague, for example. If you've ever seen the film, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, that depicts that scene in a very moving way. So Patočka is living through this event of kind of like a frustrated optimism, and followed by a further crackdown where he's unable to teach at all. His passport's confiscated. And so for the next few years, he gives private seminars in people's homes, in his own home, in what gets dubbed the Underground University. So his work gets distributed by a devoted group of students who tape record the lectures and then type up and distribute the transcripts. And one funny story I heard from Ivan Hivatic, who I was working with on the book, is that he was actually working at the Ministry of Finance at the time, and that's where they made the copies of the, the transcripts.
Wow.
Which they were able to distribute. So yes. And then in 1977, he becomes a spokesman for this charter movement. And that's when he dies.
Yeah. Just, there's so much just geopolitical turmoil, it seems like, just because of his, you know, where he's sort of situated geographically and the times that he lives through. And like you said, all the regime changes, which, yeah, all of that seems to really come to bear on his work. Moving to his work itself, what would you say are some of kind of the key themes or ideas?
Well, in his phenomenology, one or the key idea is existence as movement. So this moves away from speaking about mind and world or consciousness, as we might see in Husserl, or subject and object in a kind of Cartesian framework. So instead, he's reaching back to Aristotle as a thinker of motion and possibility, and he sort of radicalizes Aristotle's notion of life as movement. So we aren't things that move, or there's not some like substrata in which things are moving, but we are fundamentally movement. And this fascinated me because it's similar to some strands in Kierkegaard, who's likewise concerned with existence. Say, for example, the existence of the self, not as an entity, but as becoming. So it has some ties to philosophies of becoming. So within this idea of movement, we get the theme of possibility, since movement is oriented toward what is not or what is not yet. And we get the notion of openness. So openness as a fundamental feature of human being and of being. Another major theme in his work is the philosophy of history, which he describes as three movements that operate kind of both at the level of an individual life and kind of at the level of historical development as well. And just to give the very broad strokes, the first movement is one of being accepted into the world and accepting the world as it's given. So just the way, you know, children, babies are accepted into a already existing community with language and infrastructure, et cetera, to meet our needs before we're able to give back. And the second, we kind of labor to maintain that world and meet biological needs in an ongoing way. So we're sort of labor oriented toward the future meeting of needs. And the third movement, which is a crucial one, is he calls problematicity or transcendence. And in that movement, we go beyond the concerns of everyday maintenance of life and orient ourselves instead toward questions of truth and justice. So this third movement, he also describes as care for the soul. And this is a term that shows up all over Potocka's work. It's a Greek idea, but in Potocka, it means a care that goes beyond our own material well-being and the kind of maintenance of our forms of life. So care for the soul in Potocka indicates a kind of life of truth-seeking or a questioning beyond our comfortable senses of identity or our perceived limits. And another thing that he takes from the Greek idea of care for the soul is that care for the soul on the level of the individual also entails caring for the polis, for the community. So taking responsibility for our life in common. And that's why I said Potocka's work has this sort of political dimension in the very literal sense that it has to do with the polis. And maybe finally, sacrifice is a key idea, especially in Potocka's later work. So he speaks of sacrifice, and we'll talk more about this later as well, as a non-instrumental act that demonstrates a kind of break with the prevailing order of what seems possible. So for him, sacrifice signals the capacity of human being to to commit to a truth that's not recognized by the established order. And Potocka is interested in ruptures of this kind.
Did he personally meet Derrida? Because I know Derrida was making trips to Prague and just to Czechoslovakia during the 80s, at least, for those underground seminars. But did they ever actually meet? Do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Potocka did travel and do some lecturing abroad in the 60s, but by the time, but in the 70s, he was, like I said, his passport was confiscated. So he was confined to Czechoslovakia, and he died in 77. So yeah. I don't think they met, but Derrida is definitely an important reader of Potocka.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Kind of looking to the fact that Potocka, as you said, was a student of Heidegger, but also of Husserl during his student years in France and Germany. And also that, you know, sort of Potocka sees himself as a phenomenologist of some stripes. But what would you say, or in what ways does kind of his phenomenology differ from that of his teachers?
Yeah, well, he's a very devoted and very astute reader of Husserl, and he sees himself as picking up on various strands in Husserl's thought that Husserl himself perhaps didn't fully develop. And Potocka reads Heidegger as sort of doing the same thing. So he often emphasizes the continuity between Husserl and Heidegger and the ways that Heidegger is responding to specific challenges in Husserl's thought. So there's a lot of like exegesis of the two thinkers in Potocka's work. From Husserl, Potocka takes the idea that phenomenology is a philosophy that, as Husserl says, goes back to the things themselves. This is Husserl's claim for what phenomenology is attempting to do. And this is because phenomenology, in focusing on the world of our experience as it's experienced, so sometimes called the life world or the natural world, it sheds the scaffolding of a lot of previous categories and structures of philosophical thought. So this isn't to say that it's not responding to the history of philosophy or that it has a disdain for that history, but rather that it's interested in giving an account of phenomena, the way that world and beings appear to us, and that this is a necessary precondition for more conceptual systems, whether they're scientific or philosophical. So where he departs from Husserl is in the notion of transcendental consciousness that Husserl develops in his Cartesian Meditations. So he's uncomfortable with Husserl's project of attempting to ground objectivity in subjectivity, even if it is this sort of, or maybe especially because it's this empty subjectivity that he calls transcendental consciousness. So in this way, he's more aligned with figures like Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty, who give up on a phenomenology based on consciousness and instead talk about appearing as such. So Merleau-Ponty, in the way that he speaks about the visual, for example, or Heidegger in his development of ideas like Dasein, unconcealment, shining forth, the open region. These are all terms that you find in Heidegger's work. So Potocka is more in that camp phenomenologically. But Potocka is very different from Heidegger in the centrality that he gives to human community and to our responsibility for one another, as well as in his interest in the philosophy of history. So how a kind of like anthropology of how human development happens. Yeah, and others, whereas in Heidegger, you get a picture of others as the they, right? Or at least initially.
Yeah.
So in Potocka, others are the ones that accept us into the world before we are fully ourselves. They're the ones who form the referent and the meaning of all of our movement in the world. So that's a very different emphasis. And needless to say, the idea that care for the soul involves care for the polis is something totally absent in Heidegger.
Yeah, I know that transcendence is important for both Husserl and Patochka, but it seems like in very different ways, as I think you're kind of alluding to. So could you share maybe a bit the way that they conceive of transcendence differently, where it seems like Husserl, it's kind of this transcendental consciousness, like you said, whereas in Patochka, he seems to be doing something quite different with transcendence. So I wonder if maybe you could just say a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the notion of transcendental consciousness in Husserl is an attempt to see to the essence of things without the prejudices of our finite perspectives, which we always, you know, bring to every experience. This is supposed to be what the phenomenological epoche makes possible to us. So the transcendental consciousness can sort of, in transcending these individual finite perspectives, can see through to the essence of things. Patochka really takes exception to this idea for a reason I already said, but also because for him, the only kind of transcendence that it really is possible for us and that matters is our transcendence in our actions. So he, for example, stresses that the subject is always an engaged subject, never the one sitting looking at the theater, but always part of the play. And so we can't escape our finite perspective, but we can kind of transcend it through our actions in the sense of giving eternal significance to our finite actions through taking responsibility for the world and our engagement in it. So it's a very different picture of transcendence, where Patochka is much more interested in what kind of actions are possible, sacrifice is an example, that show our ability to find meaning, that the meaning of our actions that goes beyond our own kind of short lifespan and somehow reaches toward something more, something like eternity, even though he doesn't have a religious concept of that idea.
Yeah, that's well said. Okay, I know that in phenomenology, you know, finitude is kind of a matter of some importance, and that, you know, it maybe figures in some way in Patochka's thinking. So could you maybe just tell us a bit about kind of what the reality of kind of the human reality of things like finitude or fragility, what role these sort of play in Patochka's work?
Yes. So the image I'm thinking of is an image he uses of the limping pilgrim. So this is from a talk or a lecture he gave about the Czech artist and writer Josef Čapek, who died in a concentration camp. And this is a title of a collection of Čapek's essays. But the limping pilgrim here is an image of human being. And I think it's very kind of revelatory of how Patochka sees things. So the pilgrim suggests that we're always, you know, on the way somewhere. But this pilgrimage is not to any known region. We're sort of groping in the dark, but yet on a path somewhere. So our knowledge is always, you know, we're always outrunning, our actions are always outrunning our knowledge. And he describes us as being suspended between non-being and non-being. So I was not, I am, I will not be. And it doesn't get more like fragile than that.
Yeah.
But the limping part is that we limp because we're suspended between finite life and some impulse to go beyond the finite. So the idea seems to be that our finitude is inescapable, but also that, as I was just saying in your question about transcendence, that we're capable of kind of spiritually overcoming it, finding meaning in it. So in other words, the meaning of our life is not only a biological reality of birth, reproduction, and death, but we're compelled to raise questions that we're unable to answer. I mean, Kant says this as well. And Patochka sees our capacity for kind of infinite meaning and this ability to question the given, to ask about that for the sake of which we live. So this capacity is manifested maybe most saliently in the ability to sacrifice oneself for the sake of a good that's higher than the good of maintaining biological life. So to die for truth, not a truth that we know, but maybe for the possibility of truth that might be more accurately Patochka's idea. So he calls this a sacrifice for nothing, a non-instrumental sacrifice. And he likely has in mind Jan Palach, the student in Prague who set himself on fire in 1969 in protest of the troops entering the city. And for obviously sacrifice is an example of sort of meeting our finitude head on, right? Being confronted with death and also with what it means to be, you know, spiritually alive and dead, not just biologically alive or dead. Another way in which he meditates on fragility would be the fragility of human community. So our life in common is something that needs constant care, tending, rethinking, revitalization. So the arc of the moral universe doesn't just bend toward justice without people committed to, you know, working toward more just forms of governance, more just institutions, to widening the sphere of justice. So this is a lesson we're obviously learning now with certain democratic freedoms being taken for granted that are disappearing. So, I mean, that doesn't fully answer your question about finitude, but those are just some things that came to mind.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. Okay, so we're going to kind of jump topics to technology, which is maybe a big jump. But it's just the nature of these episodes. We're just getting kind of a taster of Patochka's work and life. So, I know that Patochka kind of has his own philosophy of technology, and he's similar to Heidegger in that way, who has his own kind of philosophy of technology. So, what is Patochka's view of technology? But then also, how does it compare to that of Heidegger?
Patochka uses the phrase technoscience in a few of his essays. And he seems to be drawing from both from Heidegger's essay on technology as well as Husserl's late work, The Crisis of the European Sciences. And he, in his own essay on technology, which we included in the book, which has a very long title, something about the essence of technology.
Yeah.
He sort of sketches out the Husserl's vision in that work, the crisis work, as well as Heidegger's. So he broadly shares Husserl's vision of the story of the crisis, which in broad strokes is that we have fallen into, within modernity, an objectification of our sense of reality. So modernity is, you know, for various reasons, a gradual alienation from the life world of our experience, which is a world that is already in which we're kind of fully enmeshed. You know, it's a world full of meaning. It's tied to our embodiment. So we've drawn away from that and we're drawn toward a conception of the true world as the world described by the sciences. So what counts as real is essentially what can be measured and calculated within this framework. So far, this is Husserl's picture. And Husserl refers to this sometimes as a mathematization of the world. So this ability that we've developed to mathematize the world is tremendously productive. Of course, it allows for, you know, world-changing and increasingly rapid and frightening technological developments. You know, the use of algorithms to model and predict behavior, but also to shape behavior. But Heidegger's point in the technology essay is that technology isn't simply about, you know, specific technologies changing the way we are in the world, but it's an all-encompassing frame that has to do with revelation, unconcealing. So it's a framework that sees the world and everything and everyone in it as resources to be mobilized or forces to be used. And Potochka adds to this his idea of a super civilization or meta civilization, one that presents a kind of leveled vision of reality that allows for no cracks or ruptures where, say, the divine might enter or some kind of newness might enter, but it seeks instead to kind of replicate itself and universalize itself beyond all boundaries. So this is an, I don't think this work has been translated into English, but it's a, you can find it in German and French, the super civilization. And the other, in addition to kind of Heidegger and Husserl's story, Potochka adds this idea of sacrifice, which seemed to me very odd the first few times I read his Potochka's essay on technology, because what does sacrifice have to do with a discussion of technology?
Yeah.
It does come from the end of, or it kind of seems inspired by the end of Heidegger's essay on technology, where he talks about the saving power in the destructive power or something like that. I think it's maybe a Hölderlin poem. And so what is this, you know, saving power that technology might have? So Potochka sees sacrifice as a demonstration that human life is not merely a force to be mobilized among other forces, but that human life is essentially a movement in openness. So the ability to sacrifice ourselves for nothing demonstrates to us the essence of human beings as open to truth, or able to disclose truth. And I was rereading this Potochka's essay on technology a bit today, and I found a nice little passage in which he describes this pivot to talking about sacrifice. So he says, in giving themselves for something, they dedicate themselves to that of which it cannot be said that it is something or something objective. The sacrifice becomes meaningful as the making explicit of the authentic relation between the essential core of man and the ground of understanding which makes him human, which is radically finite, that is, which is no reason for being, no cause, no force. So still a somewhat obscure notion of how how sacrifice relates to this idea of technology. But I think that pushing back against the notion of human beings in the world as resources or as a set of forces gets to the kind of heart of his critique of the technological frame that Heidegger describes.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you. That's very, very helpful. Okay, so kind of moving to your you're the co-editor of this collection, The Selected Writings of Jan Potochka, Care for the Soul, I think is the subtitle. And in your introduction to that collection, you devote actually a whole section to Potochka's idea of asubjective phenomenology, which I had not ever heard of before. So could you tell us a bit about kind of what Potochka means by asubjective phenomenology, and then maybe also how or if it signifies kind of a development more broadly within kind of phenomenology?
So I gather that the term itself comes from another phenomenologist called Eugen Fink, who was a student of Husserl, Potochka became friends with. I don't know how Fink develops it, but for Potochka, it's a step away from thinking about subjectivity understood as consciousness, with all the problems of, you know, skepticism about the world that might accompany that perspective, and toward thinking about manifestation or appearance as such, or what he calls the phenomenal field. So he finds this discovery of the phenomenal field in Husserl, but he doesn't think that Husserl develops it sufficiently, because he gets distracted by this project of trying to ground objectivity in subjective consciousness. Heidegger moves in a more explicitly asubjective direction, especially in when he insists, for example, that Dasein is not a synonym for human being, but, you know, is meant to be taken quite straightforwardly as being there. And in his notions like the clearing of being and the shining forth of being that come in other texts. Potocka also thinks Heidegger gets distracted away from the study of appearance as such by focusing on being, at least in being and time. But the field of the phenomenal field, the field of emergence, the act of appearing as separate from what appears, is the focus of Potocka's phenomenology. So he's not interested in so much in the things that appear, but in like, how does anything come to appear to us at all as like intelligible? And this phenomenal field is neither subjective or objective, but encompasses both. Now, it's interesting to see now that in philosophy of mind, for example, you have people reaching back to Husserl's model of consciousness to explore mind. And while I think that Husserl's understanding of mind or model of mind is much better than some others, it seems to me we haven't quite learned the lesson that it's not just about mind. And I think the explosion in AI is sort of making us raise these questions afresh. Yeah. But for me, the reason why subjective phenomenology seems promising is that I think it helps us respond to the environmental and human crisis that we're facing, one that comes from this severing in modernity of the human world of meaning from the, you know, purportedly objective scientific description of reality. Because for Potocka, this split between the life world and the objective world tends toward an attitude of mastery and exploitation. So the human being, you know, heroically forges meaning onto a universe that is basically indifferent and transforms and mobilizes all that indifferent matter into resources. So this ontology is problematic for Potocka and leads us in some dark places. So he's trying to set the ontology to rights by reconceiving world and human being as in mutual movement with one another. And I think this is a starting point that can lead us to care for the world and the human community in better ways. So already in Heidegger, you get a moving away from a phenomenology grounded in subjectivity. But I think Potocka wants to be very rigorous about this. And maybe in some ways, Heidegger, you know, more fully fleshes out what this asubjective ontology looks like, even though he doesn't use that term as far as I know. And this is to do with, you know, just the contingencies of Potocka's life and when he was allowed to publish and that sort of thing. So I'm not sure we get a completely worked out idea, but this pivot from speaking about, you know, subject and object to speaking about movement seems to me very, very exciting and very promising way to think about ourselves and our relationship to the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the things that maybe impresses me most to the extent that I've read Potocka's work is just kind of the capaciousness of his thought and like how many sort of different areas he's delving into in his writing. And so, you know, one of these is kind of his aesthetic and literary criticism. So in that collection that you co-edited, for instance, there's a whole section of his essays, some of his essays on aesthetic and literary criticism. And many of those that are in your collection are translated for the first time into English. But what are kind of some of the insights in particular that we can glean from his work in these fields in particular?
Well, for one thing, they're often easier to read than his more straightforwardly philosophical work. Sure. They can be a good way into his ideas. But, and as a matter of just historical record, he was quite engaged with contemporary debates in literary criticism. So like phenomenological approaches and structuralist approaches. There's a really great journal of Bohemia Literaria on this topic if people want to learn more. Personally, I find his readings of myth and of specific literary texts very compelling. So he gleans insights about time, about fate, freedom from literary works. But unlike some philosophers, they aren't just a vehicle for saying what he wants to say anyway. He doesn't use literary texts as examples of ideas. The ideas come from the works themselves and from their form particularly. And that's something I'm really interested in because I'm probably predates my reading of Kierkegaard, but he's interested as well in the way that form informs ideas and kind of modes of communication and that sort of thing. So Potocka is very, very alive to that. And I guess what I'm trying to say is he's a good reader, and that's not always true of philosophers. So he thinks of poetry and philosophy as doing different things, but he takes aesthetic experience and, you know, artistic and literary works as really vital ways of seeing and engaging with what is that philosophy can develop, but philosophy doesn't supersede them or you know, simply encompass them or something. And one of the texts we have in the collection called The Writer's Concern, or the Thing of the Writer, there he points to the important role that art has to play in reminding us that the scientifically described world is one that is derived from our more prior experience of a life world. So art, as much as it reflects the situation we're in, you know, the situation of modernity, of mathematized being, whatever you want to call it, also opens up the possibility of a different kind of relationship to being. And in that essay in particular, he contrasts the kind of capturing of life's meaning that we get in a literary work with the wider techno-scientific force toward controlling and shaping things through specialization and segmentation. So he sees a literary work as a different kind of experience that pushes back against that way of experiencing the world. And he's not speaking to any specific kind of literature, any specific kind of topic, but more like structural features of literature as dealing with the life world. And it makes me think of I'm a big fan of Musil's novel, The Man Without Qualities. And Musil does a wonderful and very funny juxtaposition of these two different perspectives within his novel. So he'll give like a scientific description of the atmospheric conditions. And then he'll say something like, in short, it was a lovely summer day. So he uses this to comic effect. Potocka is also interested in myth and the stories we tell over and over again. Maybe this is in part because his father taught ancient Greek literature and he's always been kind of fascinated with Greek culture, but not just Greek myths, lots of other myths that he describes, for example, the Faust myth. And he sees these as a real source of truth about the human condition, especially the fact that we're, you know, fated to act without knowing how things are going to go, and that we still have to take responsibility for our actions, and the guilt that accompanies, you know, this position, this existential position. So these themes come up in several of his meditations on myth. I think they're enjoyable just on the level of being, you know, good readings, and also they bring out some interesting philosophical ideas as well.
Sure. Yeah, I know that one of kind of the just key ideas that Potocka is known for is his idea of what he calls the solidarity of the shaken, where he seems to kind of be, I mean, from my understanding, seems to be kind of reckoning with the experience of guilt, but also the experience of uncertainty. So could you maybe flesh out just a bit for us kind of what he's up to with this idea of the solidarity of the shaken?
So this is a phrase that comes up in his Heretical Essays, which is a series, a collection of writing from him. And it comes up there as a description of the solidarity between soldiers on different sides of the war, the First World War, who are confronting death on the front. And the fact that the political national order kind of has them on different sides is overcome by a more profound sense of solidarity with the experience of being, loosed from all conventions, from all kind of everydayness. And more broadly, we can say that shakenness just refers to the experience of certainties coming undone. This can come from some external force that frustrates our expectations. And not everything is as extreme as, you know, the front experience. We can have, you know, disappointments of the everyday kind that lead us to to experience shakenness, or, you know, of the more world historical kind, you know, the fall of a state or an empire, the upending of our normal lives in the pandemic, or mm-hmm. as a consequence of climate change. But shakenness isn't just something that happens to us. Potochka links it to the highest movement of human life, that life and problematicity that I alluded to earlier. So our questioning of what's been taken for granted up to that point introduces us to a more sustained and deliberate mode of unsettlement, so a philosophical life of questioning and of human being as openness. And what does that look like? Well, rather than trying to make the future conform to the past and kind of narrow our circle of possibilities in order to avoid risk, we strike out on a, you know, more dangerous, uncertain, and novel path, spiritually dangerous, intellectually dangerous. So the idea that shakenness, both as something suffered and as something committed to, could be a source of solidarity is incredibly compelling, I think, because generally when we think about solidarity, we think on shared characteristics of some kind, you know, same race, same gender, same class, whatever the case might be. And so to propose a politics based on problematizing any such identity claims seems to me to respond to the kind of challenges our world is facing now and will be facing in the imminent future, where we're going to have an increase in global migration, displaced people due to climate change and economic factors, where traditional forms of community are being and are going to continue to be disruptive. So this idea is of interest to a lot of political philosophers. There's a wonderful volume by political philosopher Francesco Tava, edited volume, that deals with questions of Europe. It's called Thinking After Europe. So questions of Europe and questions of around solidarity and what that kind of means in a contemporary context, if people want to know more about this idea.
Yeah, sure. I mean, as I'm listening to you, I'm sort of hearing, and this is just me being a novice and listening, a novice of Potochka and kind of listening to you describe him, but are there kind of family resemblances between what Potochka is doing with like problematicity and sort of the unraveling of certainty on the one hand, and what kind of Derrida actually is doing with like deconstruction? Would you say that there are any kind of resemblances between these two?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think of the shakenness that Potochka is describing as more akin to a Socratic one of kind of a life committed to questioning. However, I think the basic idea of kind of striking out into uncertainty or dismantling familiar ways of seeing the world is certainly something Derrida's interested in. And Derrida also writes about things like in the hospitality essay, for example, these sorts of political social realities that I just mentioned. So I think, and also he read the heretical essays, so I know that he was familiar with this idea. Maybe it comes up in Gift of Death, I can't remember. But yeah, to the extent that he's deconstruction is not just a negative enterprise, but a commitment to something that kind of goes beyond the present order, then yeah, I think we can draw parallels between the two.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So kind of turning to Potochka's relationship with Europe or the idea of Europe, how does he conceive of sort of Europe as an entity? Does he see it as like a successful project or a failed project or maybe something else altogether? And then if he does sort of see it as a failed project, how does he have any kind of like vision for, you know, sort of a post-European age or something like that?
Well, he's preoccupied with Europe for the obvious reason that he's witnessing the dissolution of the European project in, he calls the 20th century of war. So, just seeing two world wars and living through the Cold War as well. So that maybe explains why. And also the experience of being living where he did, which was Central Europe, but then kind of became Eastern Europe, or kind of was pushed to the margins of what we call Europe. So he's doing a bit of thinking from the margins, I think. And so what is Europe for Potocka? Well, it's a kind of very intellectual ideal. So it's rooted in the idea of care for the soul and of working toward a society of justice, a society that lives in truth and recognizes the dignity of human beings as being capable of truth. So Europe as an idea has its roots in ancient Greece and this idea of care for the soul. Potocka also sees Christianity as an important part of the legacy. But Europe is a society based on openness and problematicity rather than specific national identities, economic interests, or, you know, geographical boundaries. Now, this may very well sound quite conservative and traditional, you know, a kind of idea that's been used to justify colonial endeavors, for example. So I just want to point out that Potocka is very critical of the historical European project of domination and thinks that the lust for kind of power and acquisition, either within or outside of European borders, was one of the major factors that led to the dissolution of this project. So to answer your question, yes, the European project has failed and is in some sense over. So, but he does raise the question of whether that project still has anything to teach us and whether it could be realized outside of the geographical region of Europe. And any new kind of instantiation of this project or taking up of this project would have to grapple with the failure of Europe and the failure of the instrumental rationality that kind of came to dominate the European project. Potocka doesn't answer this question of whether this project is still, you know, a live possibility. Mm-hmm. I'd say he's pessimistic that our prevailing interest in kind of controlling and manipulating life, which he calls biologism, that this, in such an environment as this, we could take up a project which is about something else entirely, soul. And the soul is that element of life that comes into view most clearly when, you know, one is cut loose from the commitment to merely remaining alive. So the loosening or the shakenness that happens in the confrontation with death or in sacrifice or in certain limit situations, as Carl Jaspers called them. Mm. So there's a sense in which the global upheavals that we're seeing now could reorient us toward a more open way of life that the idea of Europe was meant to suggest, precisely because we're in one of these moments of shaking. But then again, two world wars, multiple genocides didn't manage to do this, didn't manage to reorient us. And this is something that Potocka kind of reflects on in the heretical essays. I will say that I was quite hopeful during COVID that there would be some real kind of reckoning because the mask was sort of ripped off. The uncertainty of everything was revealed. The contingency of our projects and of our institutions and our economic systems, you know, suddenly, for example, here in the UK, well, it was the same in the US when the money that never seems to exist for anything was suddenly there to poor people who are not at work. And we thought, wow, you can just do that? Well, that's a lesson we're going to hold on to. People aren't going to forget that. And while there have been some significant shifts, like in the labor market, for example, and the labor movement, especially in the US, there's still largely a scramble to go back to business as usual. So yeah, I think we have to take this with the grain of pessimism. But Potocka himself doesn't come down on either side of the fence entirely.
Sure, yeah. Well, yeah, thank you so much for all these like very, very insightful answers. Before we come to a close, though, I want to just give you an opportunity to maybe share a little bit about your work, especially kind of, with a view to kind of what you're up to in the future. So do you have any projects in the works or anything that you'd like to kind of plug here?
Thanks. So I just released an edited volume called Kierkegaard and Possibility, which is a series of essays by really great scholars on possibility conceived from a kind of existential, ontological, and moral perspective with Kierkegaard as a guide. And like what we've been talking about here, it's about, you know, how do we relate to uncertainty and contingency? How do we do that in a hopeful way? My next project, I hope, will be a monograph on possibility, not in Kierkegaard and Potocka, but more broadly, combining a kind of ontological account with an account of our relationship to possibility. I'm really fascinated by the theme of receptivity, which is something that's important both to Kierkegaard and Potocka's accounts of human being in the world. And our receptivity to possibility is something that I'm thinking a lot about. So that's the next book. Yes.
Awesome. Well, we will definitely include a link in the show notes to the new Kierkegaard volume. Where can people find you or learn more about your work?
So I'm at the University of Hertfordshire research pages and on academia.edu. I'm on Twitter at JD_Silencio, which is for Kierkegaard fans out there. My web pseudonym has long been Johanna de Silencio, which is a feminized version of one of Kierkegaard's pseudonyms, which is one of the nerdier things that that I've done. So, yes, Twitter or whatever we're calling it these days.
Yeah, I was going to say Twitter, you have to kind of go with the nerdy handle to fit in there for sure. Great. Well, thank you so much, Erin. This has been, like I said, just really insightful, lovely conversation. I appreciate you taking some time out of your day.
Thank you again for having me.